Welcome to the Lab Up Leaders series, a showcase of global change agents and experts in healthcare and laboratory management. Here's your host, Lab Up Global Founder, Robert Farias.
I want to welcome Kirk Douglas to the Lab Up Global Leaders podcast. Kirk, nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Nice to meet you too, Robert. I hope everything is going well over there where you are.
It is. Thank you very much. Kirk, let's get started by introducing the audience to your academic background, please.
Okay. So let me start at the beginning. I'll start from the university. I was educated at the University of the West Indies Keyhill campus. I did my undergraduate degree in microbiology. That was done, and then that was also, a double major in microbiology. And that's where it all really started in terms of my love for microbiology. I remember it distinctly, almost like it was yesterday. It was one afternoon in the library, and I was just browsing for books to read, and I came across a book by Laurie Garrett. I don't remember the exact title, but I do remember the content, and it was about zoonoses, Marburg, Ebola, hantavirus, all of these weird and interesting pathogens that no one could see with the naked eye, but were causing, you know, some catastrophic epidemics and outbreaks. And that totally fascinated me. And literally, the same day that I left the library, because I couldn't borrow that book, I was just so stoked. I walked around the corner, went into my department, which is the Department for Biological and Chemical Sciences, and I saw a poster for a research project for summer research students. So this is my second year undergrad. So I said, do I really want to spend my entire summer doing research? And I said, okay, I'll go for it, because it was on hantavirus and rodents in Barbados. And who would know that that would be the actual catalyst for me becoming interested in research science and in microbiology, and specifically virology. So from that project, I was tasked with the loyal task of capturing wild rodents and testing them, which was quite an adventure. And there I had a mentor, and I want to really highlight him, he's now Dr. Michael Mathias. Back then he was now doing his PhD, and he was investigating Leptospira in wildlife, so mongoose, rats, mice here in Barbados. And he taught me how to do the dissections. He also gave me advice in terms of how to capture these rodents, and that paid off. And we were able to capture the rats, got the samples. And from that study, we had a publication, the first publication in the Caribbean on hantavirus infections amongst humans and amongst rodents in the Caribbean. And that was back in 2002, like a year after, or 2 years after the actual project. And it felt good to graduate and also have a peer-reviewed journal publication. And, you know, you're still very wet behind the ears, but you have one in the bag. And that was really, really due to the professor of the laboratory at that time. And I also want to highlight him, Professor Levette. He is, I think, with the Saskatchewan Health. I think he's the clinical microbiologist there, but he was who we patterned, and he was a template for both Michael and myself. And we really tried to, you know, reach the level that he was at. He, I think, worked with the CDC as well. So at that time, CDC was like the premier, and probably still is for many people, as it relates to public health. And from that, after that project, I spent my entire final year of my undergrad at the University of Toronto through an international student exchange program. So I moved to Canada, lived with my aunt and uncle in Mississauga, and I would have those daily commutes down to Toronto, which if you've ever been to Toronto, especially during winter, it's certainly an experience, because coming from a tropical region like Barbados and having to go through -30, -50 weather is definitely a different ball game. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I met a number of faculty, from Dr. Brown to Dr. Martin Patrick and Dr. Raymond Tellier. They were at the Hospital for Sick Kids, because after my final year of training in microbiology, and the reason why I went to UFT is because I wanted specific training in virology, which wasn't necessarily the capacity for it at the time here in Barbados, or at the university wasn't present. And I spent the summer working at Sick Kids as a summer student. I worked in the virology department in terms of, splitting blood samples, getting them ready for testing, even observe, for instance, clinical sampling and how to do the clinical samples. Like in nasopharyngeal swab, you have to really try to get good clinical material if your test is going to be, worth its salt, because if you don't sample properly, you could actually get a false negative and impact on the patient's health. And so we would have nice chats every week. We'd have coffee within the virology group, and that also stoked more passion for research. So after that stint, I returned to Barbados. I worked with the Veterinary Service Laboratory in the Ministry of Agriculture, where they would test a number of veterinary samples from across the island. And also, interestingly, also monkeys as well that are set for export for biomedical research. So that was a nice experience as well. And not recognizing that I was actually now evolving into One Health. At that point in time, we didn't have a name for it, but I was definitely on that trajectory.
Let me just interrupt briefly. Can you give me the genesis of microbiology as your first topic? So clearly you found your love in research and you found your spot there once you got in. But why microbiology to begin with? Was it so we met quite a few people who thought med school, and then if it didn't work out, they kind of switched to microbiology or medical lab sciences and other different choices. Other people who weren't quite 100% sure and thought, okay, this keeps me in the science game, so let me stay there and then figure it out afterwards. What was your scenario?
So my scenario was, I was always in sciences. I did biology, always loved biology. It came naturally. I always performed well as a student with it. So what I was able to do, because I was grounded in the area, we did our first year of undergrad. We were exposed to chemistry. We were exposed to, I think, mathematics and also biology and biochemistry. So that first year, you were then able to see, what really was your passion. I liked chemistry. We also did history. It was very, I would say, multidisciplinary. And at that point in time as a student, I couldn't understand it because I just wanted to do science. But I saw the importance of looking at different areas of our different disciplines, because it helps to spread your mind and also build connections that perhaps some other people are not able to see. But because you're a resident in that particular discipline, you're able to go, okay, maybe this has this impact. And so by the second year, I think what happened, I had a number of friends who went off to do med school and also to do veterinary school. And I really initially, from a young child, wanted to be a veterinarian, but I also loved medicine as well. But I didn't want to be either. And I found myself in a very weird space thinking, okay, I love these things, but I don't want to be either. And I always definitely kept in mind that, once you have a destiny and you have a higher power, and God leading you in the right way, then you will eventually turn up in just the right field that you would be. Because I think if I was in medicine, I'd still not feel as though I was a right fit, because I like to engage with nature. I like to go in the field, do sampling, do testing, and look at the whole pathway of the pathogen, not just only when it gets into humans. So zoonosis was just the perfect marriage between vet and medicine and also the environment. But that book and reading those books that particular day definitely was a catalyst to igniting my path into zoonosis.
So you continued all the way through to your PhD in microbiology as well, I believe. Can you just describe any of your research focuses at that point?
So after my undergrad came back to Barbados, I then had an application to a medical device manufacturing facility here on the island. It's FDA registered as well. And I thought it was a fantastic opportunity. So jumped at it, applied, and it was for a microbiologist running the laboratory, the quality assurance laboratory. So I did that. And simultaneously, I wanted to also do my master's. So the next logical step after my bachelor's was to do my master's. And so I enrolled to do my master's while working full-time. So I did my master's part-time. And during that master's program, I actually was involved in research again. And this time I tried to look for something that was novel, that was different and difficult as it was. So we looked at I investigated the likelihood of migratory birds spreading avian influenza into the Caribbean, because it's not a very well-known fact that migratory birds on their journey down south, that they do rest in the Caribbean island. This was something that I found out by chance, because where my grandmother lived, there is a pond where they actually would go shooting, you know, migratory ducks. And I never knew that this even, you know, occurred in Barbados. And one day I saw it, and then I had a conversation with the gentleman and asked him if we could sample their birds. And they say, sure, once it's for research and, you know, it's not going to harm their birds, and they're fine with that. And once that was it, then came the hard work in terms of getting the samples and then growing the virus in embryonated chicken eggs. So it was a bit of project management skills you build during your master's, bringing all of that together, managing your finances. Yeah, we're able to secure a research grant. So that was my first research grant application, and also award by the then Caribbean Health Research Council. And so we got some funding to do that. We had a lot of support as well from, I remember, one local poultry supplier. And they supplied us with the embryonated chicken eggs at no cost at all, because they were tied in terms of trying to understand what was actually going on. Because when I started, bird flu was not raging. But by the time I really got going, then it was really a problem in Southeast Asia, and then spread to the rest of the world. So long story short, we did find some avian influenza viruses, two of them amongst the samples. And at first I wasn't too sure. So being that, you know, I'm just a master's student, I'm thinking maybe this is a false alarm. And members of my research group, they kept me grounded. They're like, okay, you need to get that check first. So I did that. I sent it over to some really good scientists over at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, Dr. David Swain and Dr. David Suarez, and they were able to confirm that, yes, I did have some avian influenza samples and also Newcastle disease virus. So we published that, and that was also the first recorded study in terms of avian influenza viruses in migratory birds. Uh-huh. Thankfully, it wasn't H5, but it showed that birds from North America coming through the Caribbean do carry active influenza infections, which definitely has some risk for poultry farmers and the poultry industry in the Caribbean. And we are hoping that we could actually do something similar this year as well, because we know that avian influenza is ravaging North America at the moment, also the UK as well. And so this could become the next crisis in the Caribbean. So we have to be in front of the curve rather than be behind the curve. So that was really interesting. And out of that came a lot of offers to travel to Vietnam, represented, and also to, Oh yeah, the Fulbright scholarship. I was given an offer by the Fulbright program to do my PhD in the US at any university that I wanted. And so I had hand selected a few of them to go into avian influenza. But I had some advice from a urologist, because at that time, I think I had kidney stones and had this conversation with my urologist. And he was like, why do you want to pigeonhole yourself? He's like, why do you want to pigeonhole yourself into bird flu? I said, I like, he said, but yeah, you're a talented guy. Why you do that? And at first it didn't resonate with me, but a couple of years later, I went, you know what? He was kind of right. Because when you're, you know, have a situation in front of you, you can't really see your periphery. And it was interesting that he could see that and he shared that advice. And I didn't take up the offer at that point in time for personal reasons, but I still did my PhD. And when the opportunity came from my employer, because all of this time I was still working full time, to pursue an MBA whilst doing my PhD, to widen my horizons, I took the opportunity and I applied myself to it. It was very rigorous, very, you know, sapping energy-wise, mentally, everything. But I'm certainly glad I did, because it opened my eyes to new vistas, new range of thinking, new mechanism of thinking in terms of social sciences. And to now marry that with the experience that I have from, from the veterinary and the medical health perspectives, it's really, really rewarding. At first, the business, the MBA, was a bit difficult to kind of grasp the concepts. Not that they were terribly difficult, but when you're trained for an extensive amount of time thinking STEM, it causes you to kind of operate your brain in a different way, so to speak. So it can be a bit uncomfortable initially. But once I got going, and I think with biology, it is really about systems, whereas maths and physics, it is not all about principles. In biology, I find that it's more about systems and how you can make the connections between all the different systems. So then once I applied that process to business, then I understood that this is a process, this, and these are how these systems interact. And that made it a lot more palatable and easier to handle. I did my PhD here at the University of the West Indies at Cave Hill. I did in dengue and hantaviruses, because we wanted to look at viral hemorrhagic fevers, which seems a bit strange because we don't have Ebola, Marburg, or anything like that here in Barbados. But I was always about looking ahead rather than looking at what's now only, because you have to look at how the world's evolving. Globalization has transformed the world as we know it, and continues to transform it. Also, the internet, digital age, the fourth industrial revolution, it will transform our societies. And when you transform a society, any technology, any development, what you get is a change in social behavior, human behavior. And when you look at biosecurity, that's where the majority of the risk lies in terms of humans, because humans are a big part of the problem and a number of issues, but simultaneously, they're also a big part of the solution. So you have this dichotomy and you have to rationalize it in terms of how you're going to push and pull, push them into positive behavior and pull them back from negative behaviors. And this is where risk communication becomes absolutely important. So now, in terms of my role, I'm understanding that a bit better and seeing how we can actually craft and build that capacity for risk communication, because risk analysis is something that people are very well adept at doing. However, communicating that, those key points from the risk analysis to the people who need to know it and really understand it to change their behavior and their thinking and their ideas, that's where the value in terms of impact lies. And that's where we are at the moment, at the center. And we're really excited because we think that we definitely have an advantage, because I think with biosecurity and the way how it's viewed, not nationally, but regionally and also globally, we have a totally different concept, a more expansive view. Mm-hmm. So inclusive of what the current dogma is, but far more expansive, looking at the political, the economic, the social, the technological, the ethical, the legal aspects. And really what it was me consolidating what I learned in business with, and there's a particular framework in business called PESTL, where you actually examine the business environment if you want to enter a new market. Mm-hmm. And it looks at those things. And I went, you know what? This is interesting, because essentially what you want to do with biosecurity is do horizon scanning as well. But you want to make sure you always hold that One Health concept. So you have the environment, you have health, which is tripartite, animal, human, and also veterinary health. And looking at how all of those coalesce. So I merge all two of those aspects, and then we derive the PESTL framework. And it's something that has resonated with a number of people who've been exposed to it at present. And we're trying to see if we can get it published in a peer-reviewed journal quite soon. So I'm hopeful that that will soon happen.
Let's talk about that the center, actually, that you're referring to and you mentioned to it. So can you describe both the center and your role at the center?
Yeah, sure. So the Center for Biosecurity Studies, it actually started in 2019, but it actually initially the concept of it started around 2017 and 18. So the center was launched in 2019. I became the director in 2020, so just during the pandemic, July 1st, 2020. So it was conceptualized by Professor Akin Abayomi. He's another mentor as well. And he is actually the health commissioner for the state of Lagos in Nigeria. And he's also a very key member of the GET consortium in Nigeria and Africa. And I think the GET stands for Global Emergent Pathogen Treatment Consortium. And this is a group of African scientists looking to see how they can tackle biosecurity and One Health issues across Africa, because I guess you can appreciate that that's really hotbed of a number of viral hemorrhagic fevers and emerging infectious diseases occurring across the globe. And so what we are hoping to do is to get that done. Yeah, and that was interesting because it was a flashback to, again, the library scene, the book, and then the journey from there now to the center, which is actually looking at a number of biosecurity threats that threaten the Caribbean. So we then redefined biosecurity. Most of the definitions surrounding biosecurity at the moment is examining or looking at animal, plant health, human health, and the environment. So essentially the One Health area. And as I would have mentioned, our perspective is broader. And we then try to see how we can distill that into a definition. First, what we did is we looked at the word biosecurity. And as we have learned from primary school, also at secondary school, when you come across a word that you don't know, you break it down into the syllables or, you know, compound word, pull apart, find out the original meaning of that prefix and suffix, and then put it back together and you'll get the true meaning of the word. And that's essentially what we did with biosecurity. So bio is from the word bios, which is Greek, which means one life. Then security is from the Latin securus, which means freedom from anxiety or freedom from care. So when you put both together, what biosecurity really means is one life with freedom from anxiety or one life with freedom from care. So it's incorporating all aspects of life. And it's all about lives and livelihoods and protecting them. Because the whole concept of biosecurity is really about systems and protocols and procedures to prevent harm from coming to, you know, persons. Let's say, for instance, in the context of your home, you have windows, you have doors, you have a number of different things within your home that you've set up to protect yourself from the elements, to protect yourself from, you know, dangerous wildlife, or even, you know, vermin, mosquitoes, rodents. cockroaches, stuff like that. And you may also even have principles or policies within your home that you don't even recognize that you do, because when you do come into someone's home, first thing you may do instinctively is take off your shoes, because there is kind of an unwritten policy that you shouldn't walk with your dirty shoes in someone's home. And essentially, when you look at it, the windows and doors are your border security that you have in your nation. Those are the checks and balances that you want to keep out stuff that you know are harmful. And that is really what best security is. So when you think of best security, oftentimes people look at it in a really formal sense. But the way how we want people to embrace it and take it is that this is something that you just do. It makes perfect common sense. It's just natural to want to protect your family, your loved ones, and in your space. So that is what we're doing, regardless of which space it is, whether this be the farm, whether this be even in your office, because with COVID-19, that also became important. And to rearrange and shift that thinking and get people to think in terms of systems. And for whichever system you're dealing with, biosecurity is a part of it, and a very integral part of it, and that you actually practice it. So it's not something that's so out of your reach as well. It is actually something that you may even practice every day.
Yeah. Just talk about one more aspect of your professional experience, the H3E Caribbean Initiative. Can you speak to that for a little bit, please?
That was a really interesting development. So that was another mentor. I must commend Professor Simon Anderson. He's the director of the Chronic Disease Research Center, the George Allen Chronic Disease Research Center, and that examines a number of NCDs, non-communicable diseases, here in Barbados and across the Caribbean, and conducting some really sterling research in those areas. And he reached out to me, and we had a number of conversations that actually shared the SEO framework. And he was really stoked about it and said that we should publish, and we are going to publish it. But I really thank him for also mentoring and supporting and encouraging me as well, being new in the role. I think he was also new in the role. He's also connected with co-director for a center at the University of Glasgow in Scotland as well. So he's been instrumental, and he was part of this H3E Caribbean project. And what the three H's stand for is human, heredity, and health. And the E component is the environment. So this particular initiative was actually patterned after the H3 Africa initiative, which was very successful for over, I think, 10 years, 11 years. They actually received over $250 million in funding to build capacity within Africa to do biobanking, to do, equipping laboratories, data collection systems, because essentially what it was a response to is the disparity in data, biomedical data, in terms of understanding the role of human genetics with whatever disease it might be. But one thing it did lack was the link with the environment. And so when it came around time to conceptualize this particular initiative, that's what they did. There's also Professor Alexandra, she's with Harvard University, the Genomic Center there, and also the Broad Institute. And what the intent there is to do is to draft a white paper to then submit to NIH, because Dr. Samuel Rotimi, he was very instrumental in Africa receiving that, the H3E Africa program receiving that funding, because he was at the NIH in the USA. And he's also a very close friend of Professor Alexandria. And so she actually is the person really behind driving it, trying to get it in. She's had significant experience too in working in Jamaica with JACRI, which is another institute that looks at cancer and cancer treatments in Jamaica. And also some other chairs as well. The key thing that Professor Anderson did, he actually approached me and he asked me if I would want to be a part of this project. So when he detailed to me what exactly he was looking at, I said, yeah, this would be just would be perfect in order to try to help the region accelerate the development of, you know, laboratories, biobanking, genomics, and also omics, other omics, such as proteomics and all the other omics studies, because that's where I think we need to focus if we want to be able to tease out the different environmental triggers and also the different factors that are behind and driving the level of, NCDs that we're seeing within the Caribbean. We have a preponderance of these NCDs that are cropping up, and our people are becoming less and less healthier. And there has to be a reason why, and we need to understand it in order to fix it. So I think this will definitely go a significant way in doing that. And so I was asked to chair this environmental group, and I asked another colleague of mine who's been a really good mentor, Professor Dwayne Devenish, and he's a behavioral social scientist. And so he was instrumental in shaping the psychosocial aspect of the environment as we were researching it. And so having him as a co-chair in that environmental group for the H3E Caribbean project was really, really, really good. So we did do a literature review. We submitted that to the overall chairs. And right now, I think the next step is to actually submit the white paper closer to the end of the year to NIH to see if we can get the first approval and then hopefully some funding as well. But yeah, it is definitely something that we are very interested in.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Another one of many accomplishments of yours. And so, and that leads me to the next question, Kirk, is that, so a lot of younger people who are currently in the field of studies or early graduates are trying to figure their way out and say, where should I go with my path? You've had the advantage of taking many of these paths, and you've gone down the research realm, and you've gone through the capacity development realm, and now in the biosecurity space and understanding the environmental side, but also still conducting your own research as well throughout all these aspects, in addition to the business component and the quality assurance. And I can probably spend the next 30 minutes eliciting the rest of your successes. But a younger person trying to get in, trying to understand what their way should be going forward, any general advice you have for them of either areas to focus on, some future trends they need to be prepared for, or just some general ways to develop themselves over time?
I think one thing is important is self-awareness, spiritual connection, and self-esteem. Understanding who you are, why you are here, your purpose, finding that out. Because when you find that out, then that is something powerful. That is something that will be almost like a nuclear reactor, a nuclear fuel to get you through. Because there will be highs and there will also be lows. But when you are committed, when you are passionate about your purpose in terms of why you were birthed into this world, why you are here, and the assignment that you are on, then that is very powerful. And no matter what storms come, and they will come because this life, you will be successful because you are on your path, your destiny to get to where you were designed to be. And that is very important. So this is outside of, it's inclusive of science, but this is more in terms of the whole person. I think that is important because you don't want to get lost in work alone. You want to be a well-rounded person. That's something that I work very hard to try to see if I can be, because you can meet some really brilliant scientists who are just not very nice people. And that is an unfortunate reality. There are not many, but it happens. So I think it is very important to have that social connection with those loved ones, those people that you love. It helps to round you. And when your engagement with people outside of the laboratory, because what you do in the lab, you really want to have an impact in society. So understanding and communicating with people in society is important to get a sense of where the demand is for the solutions that you can bring to bear. And I think and it comes back to understanding who you are, because if I felt like I had to be a doctor, if I felt like I had to be a veterinarian, then I would be so despondent and I would have lost my way and Lord knows what would have happened. But knowing that I have a purpose, knowing who I am, and that is okay to be not within a certain lane or lanes, but that you're charting your own path, because your own path then puts you in a rare space that really makes you special. And to have that feeling and appreciation of yourself is very important. And just being able to know your path, know your direction, and being able to stick to it, because you never know what will happen in life. Things change, and being adaptable is very important, and resilient. That will serve you through life, no matter which field you go into. These are just some, you know, soft skills that I think are very important that can be, you know, transitioned through any particular discipline. But if you are really intent on like studying diseases, especially infectious diseases, I would say zoonotics, climate change as well, understanding how the environment plays, because with disease, there are three main factors. You have the environment, you have the pathogen, and then you have also the host. So changes in those three, what you consider the disease triangle, will affect infectious disease dynamics. And what we're seeing and what we're witnessing at the moment is just that. You're seeing a change in the environment, obviously propelled by climate change. Then you're seeing a change because of the change in climate. There is a change in host behavior. And so people are changing their preferences. You know, people want exotic pets now. That's really at the root of the monkeypox outbreak that we're seeing ongoing at the moment. So it is kind of looking at infectious diseases, yes, but from a more broader perspective, so that you can connect those dots and inform science, inform policy, inform even techniques. I think that is where the new movement of scientists, especially in infectious diseases, will come about. And we are just excited to be just a part of it, because we know it's much bigger than what we're doing, but we want to be able to have an impact, and a significant one at that.
Great advice. Thank you. Normally we'd ask our guests as a final question if they want to recognize any mentors or supporters along the way. So you've trumped my question by covering them throughout the entire episode, but any additional mentors or people you'd like to acknowledge that have been good sources of support for you and encouragement along the way?
Yeah, I would like to also speak about my PhD supervisor, Dr. Marquita Gillen-St-Hilaire. She was very instrumental in allowing me to go on the path that I wanted to go. So giving me that leeway to do that. Also, Professor Alafia Samuels, she was really key in pulling my thesis together. She was at the time the director of the Sir George Allen Chronic Disease Research Center. So her advice was very instrumental in me successfully completing my PhD. There are also some other mentors that I met on the way. Dr. Byron Martina from Netherlands, because with my PhD, it was very diverse. I did some research with a new group in Amsterdam at the Erasmus Medical College. That was really, really good. And he was a really good mentor. He's from the Caribbean originally, but he's emigrated to the Netherlands. He's done a really, really great job and is still doing a really great job. Artemis One Health is his organization. And he's also worked with Professor Osterhaus, who many would know if they're into virology, as the person who discovered SARS, the original SARS virus. And also Dr. Tarja Saarinen from the University of Helsinki in Finland. These are people that I've worked very closely with in terms of research. And also Dr. Charles Chu from the University of California, San Francisco. These are very good mentors in trying to direct me in terms of research and build that capacity. But definitely, I'm all thankful. So when you see an individual, you know that there are a collection of different mentorships that all coalesce into one. And I really appreciate all the time and all the effort that they have poured into me in my development. And I see that as something that I want to replicate with young persons who are desirous to go on these different paths.
Great. No, that's great. Thank you very much for that. And I know with the amount of different activities you've participated in, Kirk, there's probably, I can keep you for another hour or two just to name all the extra people you've worked through and helped and have helped you as well along the way.
But yeah, I'd also, before I go, Professor Eudine Barreto, she was also behind the conceptualization of the center. And she's always provided me with some sagely advice. And also don't tell me his name escapes me at the moment. He's the deputy principal of the university, but he was always from the very get-go, even before I started my position at the center. He was always a good mentor as he was heading the graduate studies, and so I had sit-downs and conversations with him. So nothing formal in turn, but just having someone to bounce ideas off, get some direction. He was very, very instrumental. So Professor Winston Moore. Yeah. Okay. No name. I can't believe that I forgot.
No problem.
But definitely, yeah. And also my current mentor as well is Professor Troy Lard. He's actually my direct report, and he's been very instrumental too in shaping the way forward as well. So like I said, it's multiple people that have really contributed. And that list will continue to grow because I try to remain teachable, remain open to learning new things and experiencing new things, because in that way, that's the only way to grow. And when you do grow, it's often uncomfortable at first. That's what people have to kind of appreciate. And it's not always pleasant, but it is oftentimes very necessary. If you want to adapt and if you want to grow and change.
Yeah. Well, Kirk, thank you very much for joining us today. We certainly hope to follow up with you in the future and see all the progress of all these different initiatives you're part of and new ones that you're setting up. And certainly, I imagine down the road, there'll be many people who mention you as a mentor and either through direct information or through the use of your various frameworks that you're developing that others can build upon. And help structure their research futures as well. So thank you very much for participating and kudos for your success at this point.
Thank you too. And all the lessons on your program and your, all the activities that you have ongoing. I really enjoyed this particular sit down and chat. And I hope that this won't be the last one. And I think for the region as well, it would be nice to have a lot more persons from within the region who've contributed significantly to the development of research and science to be highlighted and given an opportunity to share their views. So I really want to really sincerely thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you.
To make a suggestion of someone that would make a great guest or topic you would like to hear more about, please visit us at labop.org. That's labopp.org.